I'm Senator Gail Schlossberg, and along with Representative Spallone, we are the co-chairman of the Commission on Enhancing Agency Outcomes. And I'm delighted to have you all here, as you know. For the people watching at home, the Commission on Enhancing Agency Outcomes is a commission that was created by statute in March this year with the purpose of streamlining government functions and how we do business and finding efficiencies and redundancies and eliminating them with the hopes of providing better government at a better price. Today's presentation is on technology and how we can find efficiencies and improvements through the use of technology. I am delighted to be joined here as well. I wanted to just recognize that we have the Yale Law School Legislative Services Clinic with us. Where are our folks there? There they are. All right, terrific. Well, nice to have you here. It's a pleasure. We hope that you'll have learned something here or have some interest in the things that are going on and provide your insight and expertise. We're also joined today by Ross Salonia, who is the general manager of the Siemens Building Technologies Incorporated in Cromwell, Connecticut. Ross, you want to? Hi, Ross. Nice to see you. He's responsible for sales service and installation of Siemens building systems in non-residential buildings, management of data centers, and developing and implementing energy conservation programs. We also have Jeff Young, who is with systems integration also with Siemens, and his focus is on active energy management and data center energy audits, transformation data centers, desktop virtualization, and a variety of other things. We're also delighted to be joined by Bob Kesselman, who's down on the other end, who comes out of the Yale School of Management, several years ago, and is currently an IT productivity and efficiency consultant who has extensive experience in ERP systems and supply chains. We're delighted also to be joined by Yvonne Hickey, who is the account sales manager and a member of the North American Solutions Group and public section operations of Xerox. So I welcome our invited guests. We have a number of people who are also following this presentation by video and by television and who will be providing assistance to the commission as well. We're delighted to be joined. Our first presenter is Jerry Basile and Renee Herrer, and we're also going to be hearing from Stuart. And Stuart, I'm not going to get your last name right. Bensky. I'm okay. And I've got a big sign here that says we have to be out of the room by 12:30. So with that, I just turn the microphone over to my co-chair for any comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have very little to say because I want to get started. But I just wanted to welcome everyone. Thank you for your participation, the members of the commission that are here today as well. Thanks for your attendance. I do have to leave a little bit early today, around 11:45 or so, due to a funeral I must attend. But I look forward to what you have to say and getting some more information. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, with that, I think we'll just get ourselves started. And so I'm delighted to welcome Jerry Basile, who is going to be starting with a presentation this morning. Good morning, Jerry. Thank you for being here.
And good morning, Senator. Good morning, Representative. Thank you for having us here today and the commission members and guests. We're delighted to be here today, and we hope you find today's presentation, thought-provoking and innovative, and that's what we're here to do. This is meant to be a very interactive agenda today, so as you ask questions throughout the presentation, feel free. This is very much interactive. I'm here with several IBM colleagues today in addition to our guest speakers. I'll just briefly introduce them, and during the course of the day they may interact with you. We have Wendy Monahan from IBM Public Sector, Frida Ue from IBM Government Industry, and to my right is Shelley Mills Brinkley from our IBM Global Services Human Services Organization. As you know, I am here today, and I just want to make this very clear. This is not an IBM sales pitch. We're not here to pitch anything today. This is, again, to give you some innovation and thoughts as to how you go about achieving efficiencies and reducing cost in government. We do have a vested interest in helping out the state of Connecticut. We have almost 4,000 employees and their families who either work or live in the state of Connecticut. So we do have a vested interest in helping Connecticut achieve and reduce cost savings here as we enter this and go through this economic crisis. So with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Renee Hare, who is, just to give you a little bit of background and bio on Renee, she was a former director of operations with the state of Georgia with a very strong IT background. And prior to that, she was also the director of IT for the American Cancer Society. So she brings a very strong flavor in terms of infrastructure, cost backgrounds, et cetera, and hands-on work that has accumulated her knowledge of this. So we have two presentations that we're doing here this morning. These are only two of a very small, a subset of areas that you could take a look at, but it's meant to be one on the infrastructure side and one on the programmatic side, and Stuart will address that in the afternoon, mostly on the centering around human service agencies, since those tend to be the largest agencies within an executive branch of government. But for now, let's talk about the infrastructure, and I'm going to turn it over to Renee.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. We're going to work off of a presentation. If you have it in front of you, then I won't worry about the fact that it's in back of you. Otherwise, let me start. Y'all have it in front of you? Okay. Oh, great. Y'all have technology up there. So a couple of things, and feel free to ask me questions. I've actually, as Jerry said, I've lived this on from both sides now. I was about 5.5 years as a senior operations officer for the state of Georgia, the Georgia Technology Authority, and now I've been with IBM working in technology services, helping other states achieve things. Public sector is what I'm assigned to, so I see a lot of what's happening in other states, other public sector environments. So the first thing we're going to talk about on our agenda is trends that we're seeing in state and local government. Examples of transformed services in other states, and then another state initiatives and approaches, things that are starting to happen. Everybody is, this is a perfect storm. Most states are now looking at what they can do because of the economics. They have to really look at what are the other options, what are better, more efficient ways of achieving things. So you'll see some bills that are now in place in other states where they're trying to get some traction. And then last, we'll go through some examples of cost savings approaches. And then I'll turn it over to Jerry, who'll talk about a more programmatic approach. This whole session, or this section, will be more about your infrastructure and what you can do about the IT infrastructure. So on the next slide, I'm not going to obviously read this to y'all, but this is IBM's view of what's happening. And, the themes in it really is about, we're seeing a lot of states reaching out to the private sector now, trying to collaborate and work with external service providers to figure out best practices and ways to make their partnerships with their customers, the citizens, more effective, more efficient, and get some of utilize the private sectors as a change agent, because sometimes it's difficult to do that internally. So it's a lot easier to have an external provider begin those processes that are pretty difficult sometimes in a change agent role. And then they're looking at implementing transformation. Everybody's starting to realize that some of the legacy environments are old, they're costly in maintenance, they're costly in that it's difficult anymore to get the skills and the staff to be able to achieve some even stability to the old legacy systems or even keep them running. They're also looking at different programs, way they can run different programs, where they can maybe redesign the entire business process and the technology with it to get more efficient call centers or things like that. And then, of course, they're looking for lower costs, highest service levels, and more citizen-centric. So everybody's certainly looking to what can they provide from the web, what can be call centers, what things can they do for their citizens that are cost-effective but are still that high-touch, get the citizen what they need type services. We go to the next slide. These are things that are really kind of the areas where they're, I would call their pain points and things that create areas for consideration. Human resources. In most states, they're starting to have hiring freezes. They've taken a lot of loss already in some of the staff. They have legacy skills in an aging workforce who's getting ready to retire, and it's difficult for them to be able to even keep the lights on, so to speak, or keep those mission critical systems running. So they're looking at how can they get better access to IT skills, how can they keep the day-to-day operation running. What a state does on a day-to-day basis is not only mission critical, it's public safety, it's, you know, our child and human sources are critical to the public at large, so the day-to-day operation can't be jeopardized by lack of human resource skills. And they want to be able to focus on their core business, and their core business isn't IT, typically. It's about serving the citizens with services. So the human resources is one of the areas that's really making states step back, and quite frankly, most organizations today step back and look and say, okay, what else can we do to be better and more efficient? And then best practices of government and the private sector world, business application development, looking at better ways, getting things that are more efficient in that you can put them up quicker, faster, make them more flexible in being able to deliver them. The biggie for everybody, but certainly states, is better security. Security can not only be costly in the systems, but it's very costly if you have a breach. Not only is it costly in being able to mitigate the situation, but it is very, very costly in your reputation when the citizens, or even a customer, of a credit card company, quite frankly, finds out that their data has been breached, right? Very, very important. Business continuity and disaster recovery, the thing that for many years everybody's considered the insurance plan, and that maybe they could get away without that insurance plan, and then the disaster happens and they realize maybe not. So everybody's getting to be much more focused with all the natural events we've had going on, much more focused on being able to figure out how they would continue business and how they would recover from a major disaster. Costs that are predictable and stable. So really starting to look at it, this is hard for a state when you have an IT organization that services agencies. It's hard for a state to set up what we call service levels, where you predict what type of service you're going to provide, and then you publish that, and your customer expects that, and if they don't get that, then there's some sort of a financial penalty or something involved in not getting the service that you were told you were going to get. State, that's hard because, how does the state kind of like penalize its own agencies, right? The interesting thing about that is, so that leaves everybody up to subjective decision making around whether or not they're getting the quality of service that they think they should be getting. Because what you think is good service and what I think is good service and what somebody else thinks is good service are, when they're subjective, they're not defined, they're not written down, you know what to expect, it can be all over the board. So states are starting to and look at this and say, hey, we need to be able to figure out a way to make it predictable so that we can measure it and say, hey, I got the service I asked for, I can see it, I benchmark it, and I'm paying for what I think I should be receiving. Higher IT service and reliability, improved customer service falls in that area. So those two things kind of come together with how can you measure the services, how can you benchmark them, how can you achieve them, and then how can you hold somebody accountable for them. And we talked about web enablement. On the next slide, so they're looking to be able then, as we talked about earlier, give access to enterprise information and services, being able to not have to have, and this is everywhere, multiple databases with your name in it multiple times because it's captured in multiple places, and so when you go to get your hunting license, it's not known that you have a driver's license because they're in separate databases, where that would be so much easier, and in some states are even starting to be, pretty interesting processes with this where they tag you if you try and get a hunting license, but you have your deadbeat dad or something like that. They're trying to get the databases lined up so that they can be able to show an enterprise view of a citizen. Enhanced business processes and quicker IT enablement. We kind of talked about something that's much more flexible, faster to put up, faster to change when the business world changes. And then contractual relationships. In state, probably or in any in government entity all around, one of the most difficult things to do is to procure. There's all of the processes you got to go through, so it makes sometimes that whole flexibility and the ability to adapt and change quickly difficult because you got to go through all the processes. So they're looking for ways to stay in line and in the true spirit of public procurement, but to be simplified and make them more efficient in the way they can get through that whole process. And then in technology, they're looking at how can they upgrade and refresh their hardware and software when probably most of them no longer have capital upfront money they can spend. Some of them are taking big digs into their operating budgets, so you know, from capital for refresh, very difficult. And that leads into the IT optimization and better value for their investment and reduction of the capital outlay. And then consolidation, standardization, automation are all about the things I've talked about earlier, getting the best flexibility infrastructure that they can to be able to deliver faster, quicker, cheaper. And then to replace those ancient legacy systems that are costly to maintain, and they have to keep trying to find skills that are very hard to find anymore, and they just can't be. There's in many cases they're not as reliable as the newer systems that are designed under newer technologies. So if there's no questions, and this one I just for you to look at.
Do you mind if I interrupt?
No, not at all. If people have questions, by all means, go for it.
Can I ask just a little bit about what you mentioned about consolidation?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to go against some of the things that you mentioned on the previous page about flexibility.
Okay.
That if there are multiple vendors or multiple points of access, say, to the Internet, it seems to provide for better redundancy and more reliability than a consolidated system. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So you architect your consolidated environment so you have all of that redundancy built in.
Which is expensive.
Not necessarily. It's lots of times it's much cheaper because you can have one or two contracts that leverages across all of your user base as opposed to smaller shares of your organization negotiating what the best they can with their smaller volumes in their contracts. Okay. Please tell me if I don't answer your question. I'll be glad to go further.
He will.
I probably will come back to that. But
that's okay. And I'll talk a little bit more about consolidation in some later slides that might help you as well. So these are more for you, and I'm not going to walk through these. They're taking what I just talked about and putting them into really what we see as the focus areas that states are looking at and in government entities and, quite frankly, the private sector as well. So we'll just kind of flip through those. And then this slide is going to come up twice, and I'll tell you why, because you're going to look at it and go, I don't understand the key. So I'm going to show you this, and then let's flip to the next two slides, and so you can see the key to what and Jerry was really fast on that. What the full ball means, the three-quarter ball means, and the half ball means when you look at this. And then also, go ahead, Jerry, you can do it again. And then what the terms across the top, MMIS claims processing, that's about Medicaid Management Information Systems, which a lot of states outsource today or have managed service of. So that's why that one's being called out separately. Non-MMIS business processes, so other business processes that states are looking at, how can they consolidate them, how can they better design them, better architect them, ones that are IT outsourced, and then ones that are application management. So if you flip back, you'll see then, or flip forward, I'm sorry, you're right there, you'll see that chart again. You'll see where a lot of states have started a lot of initiatives either in their a lot have done, as I said, the MMIS stuff, the managed Medicaid. Number have looked at non-MMIS business processes that they can either do more efficiently or have somebody else do more efficiently. Several have done some sort of a partial IT outsourcing or whole IT outsourcing. You'll see there's about four that have done entire IT outsourcing. The rest have done some partial. And then application management, which is a service where a provider manages your application, designs your application, and updates and maintains your application for you. I'll give you a little while to digest that one. You tell me when you're ready to flip. It's a lot. But now this is compiled by IBM, obviously. This is our insight to what we see happening. There may be things out there we're not aware of. Oh, I'm sorry. Wasn't looking that direction.
Could you define application a little bit more specifically?
An application is your ERP system. It could be your child welfare system. Things that people used to call them software, but today they're considered applications because they run an entire business process for you. Y'all can study that one later. This is an example of the four states that have completely outsourced their IT operation. Texas is now, and I'll go into these a little deeper so you don't have to read all this either, but it was a snapshot of who's gone that direction and the type of savings they're expecting to see. And then,
Those are one-time savings? Those are annual savings? Those are over the life of the contract?
Over the contract period.
You know, Virginia's looking at a $300 million savings. That's over a 10-year period?
Yes, ma'am. We'll go through it. We can flip through them. But yes,
yeah,
ma'am.
I think we might be interested in hearing some details.
Yeah, Virginia's I'm probably least familiar with because obviously it's done by Northrop Grumman. But that is, yes, that is their take on it. We'll flip the next one. Texas is. It's was $863 million. It's over 7 years. They signed it in 2006. And as you see, by 2008 to 2009, their fiscal year, they expect a $25 million savings. And then over the contract period, it's $159 million.
And are they using current dollars? They're just, you know, or is there that $863 million, is that
that's
a reallocation of existing?
The operational budget moved from them to spend on their vendor. Right. Okay. So it's an operational cost. It's like paying the utility bills. Georgia, I wanted to show you this one. Obviously, I'm familiar with this one since I live there. This one has just signed. It's signed in November. And it has, in April, IBM took all of the staff from the state of Georgia, so they all have jobs. And matter of fact, in most of these cases, no matter what the vendor, they want the staff. The staff is critical to a smooth transition and a better operation. They expect to see $180 million in savings across their contract. Now, what you see there, and we'll talk about this a little bit in some of the services, is in the first phases of the process. We went through the bid process and how quickly that happened, the infrastructure and the mainframe, and then went to contract award, and then the transition, and they are now at 4-1, and that happened exactly on time. But what they'll do in that transitional phase now is some things called storage and server optimization. They're going to be doing a whole new process for them to be able to. Georgia has an authority, GTA, that procures all the service. It has the contract with the vendor, and then it charges its agencies back. So there's a whole new chargeback mechanism going in. The agencies can see what they're paying for. There's a catalog going in. They can order it, like, you know, going on to Amazon, putting it in their basket, and it's being measured by service levels. So they know what they've signed up for, and they know when it has been hit or when it's been missed, and there are penalties associated with a miss. So there is an objective view to the services that they're getting. And all of these are built like that.
Thank you. So just so I understand what you mean by IT outsourcing, we in Connecticut we have our core CT system, which is sort of our main system. So in essence, what Georgia and Texas and these other states did is take that whole system and outsource it to a private vendor?
They did. In Texas, a number of the, almost all the agencies are involved in that. And in Georgia, it was the central IT organization, GTA, and then 12 of the very largest agencies. So Department of Labor, I'm sorry, that's the one that is new, Department of Human Resources, Department of Corrections, Department of Community Health, all the ones that are the big ones that are under the executive branch were also being consolidated into, it wouldn't just be about the consolidation into the data center, but they're being consolidated in under this contract.
And where does the dollar savings come from?
It comes from the transformational phase that they're going through. So they're going to be, you have all these servers out in data centers, and you know, a data center today, by definition, could be anything from a wiring closet that you have a server kind of just shoved into to something under, you know, in a desk environment to big data centers that have disaster recovery and those types of things built in them. So they are doing a lot of the cleanup of the servers and going to a virtualized server environment. They're taking a lot of the storage out of the agencies and combining that into a more virtualized, and I'll talk about what that means, storage environment, and they're helping them use a more consistent strategy for their security. So all of that, they had multiple contracts for that. They have multiple people duplicating those efforts because they're in the agencies or they're in the central IT organization. Each agency picked its own type of technology. So all of that coming together in that transformational phase, the outsourcer will see the cost savings it needs. And what Georgia chose to do is, because of capital outlay, they chose to take a lot of that transitional cost and leverage it over time and pay for it as an operational expense. So then when it gets picked up and run by the outsourcing vendor, then it's being run by a best practices organization as well. So using more of the types of technologies I talked about, where you have a catalog, you can order your stuff online, that's much more efficient. You can see your bill online, saving paper, saving costs. It also helps with energy efficiencies across these buildings, removing some leases from some of the agencies, all those types of things is what it comes from. It's space savings and things like that. Mm-hmm. That some agencies had data centers that they'll no longer need.
Thank you.
Okay, and then, so one that's really kind of gone what we call vertical is California Child Welfare Services. They took that whole service, the application development, the infrastructure, all the way down to the desktops and the help desk, and outsourced that as a service. So it's not their whole, like we talked about with Georgia or Texas, their whole IT operation. It's really just that line of business.
Does that mean that you've got the contact with the public is through IBM or, you know, through the outsourcer, as opposed to when you say the whole program, can you just define a little bit more about, you know, in terms
like
of real
that.
People, what we're talking about, the system, how what it looks like?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Shelley Mills Brinkley, and I'm the partner within IBM who's responsible for social services nationwide. And what's going on in California is the social workers who interface with the clients, they're still state staff, and they're interfacing with the clients. The technology underpinning that supports the child welfare application out there, the equivalent of a SACWIS type system, if you will, statewide automated child welfare information system, IBM took responsibility of all the underpinning technology from the state, and because the state saw cost savings in IBM running the underpinning technology for the solution. But the actual social workers who interface with the families in need, the children in need, and that type of thing, those are all still state social workers who are working with the client.
So where is the savings then there? If you're just taking over the technology side of this, how does that really create savings then for us?
In the state of California, let me just step back for 1 minute. So in this presentation, they're talking about the technology piece, but there's also a business side that Stuart will be talking about later that will drive cost savings out of programmatic, from a programmatic perspective and from an administrative cost perspective as well. But from a technology perspective, in terms of consolidation of the technology, because hardware and software is not dispersed all over the place, it's not duplicative all over the place. You're not having unused resource within the technology because you're not using all the capability of a piece of hardware and that type of thing. So leveraging that hardware across the board and using it to its full capacity in a consolidated way drives the cost out of the business. Does that answer your question?
I think for now it does. I think there's so many details that we're probably going to... Oh, yep, they're going down there. Okay, Bob, go ahead.
In a fully outsourced solution, who's going to own the equipment?
In a fully outsourced solution, the equipment can be owned by the state government in this instance, or
right.
It can be owned by the vendor.
Right.
It depends on what
the contract would manage it, set the architecture, et cetera, correct? Okay. So what you're trying to say is,
Bob, they asked you to repeat it.
So that you will manage and design the infrastructure, decide where things go, make recommendations about how the equipment's going to be set up, et cetera, if you were the outsourcer, for example, correct?
Yes, that's one of the ways.
So what you're trying to tell Senator Schlossberg is you're going to provide better websites, better information, conduits on less equipment and a more efficient setup using less real estate, less electricity than the state can do, correct? That's where the savings comes from.
So that can be an answer, or
okay.
The state can do it themselves. They can do that type of a transformation, and
right.
I'll talk about that in some later slides.
Okay.
They can find those efficiencies themselves, and it would be a question about whether or not they would have the resources so they could do it and run it themselves,
right.
Or have somebody come in and help them do that, because it's a lot to ask people who are keeping the lights on to also do a transformation.
No, understood.
But they could stay and run it themselves.
A continuum
yeah.
where the state and its consultants and its contractors will pick some spot where they're going to be able to do more and get more information with less.
Correct.
Fewer people, lower payroll, lower real estate, lower electricity, et cetera.
Exactly.
I
correct.
Wanted to know if that was helping you
yeah.
with the question that you were asking.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
That's absolutely. Because in California, think about the size of the state. You know, hardware, meaning PCs and servers and mainframes, all distributed all over the state, and it was for child welfare. And the reason, exactly what you're saying, if you take out the cost of the buildings and that type of thing and outsource that infrastructure, California saw that as a major cost savings to them. We are actually hosting their application, not even in California, but in Boulder, Colorado. So really they got rid of all of the infrastructure kind of costs, buildings, servers, laptops, you know, those kinds of things. But they kept all the people, because, of course, the business knowledge of interfacing with customers would have to come from the social workers, especially in the child welfare kind of environment.
Thank you very much. Shelley, did you have a question?
I did, and it may be leaping ahead to the next presentation, but perhaps as you go through both presentations, you can address this. From the standpoint of the consumer, you know, take child welfare as an example. As you do this transformation in terms of the infrastructure, are you also figuring out ways of measuring, for example, the performance of an individual social worker and her capacity to move a child to permanency? And how do you how do you integrate metrics of performance of the state agency as part of a transformation, because it provides a great opportunity to do that.
Yes, it does. And Stuart Vinsky is going to be talking about some of those things in terms of, you know, driving costs out the business but still keeping high performance when you're talking about working with families and social workers' performance in terms of doing business services, if you will, as opposed to technology underpinning kind of discussion. So Stuart will be covering that in his presentation.
Thank you. Jeff, did you have a question?
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about what the improvements have been relative to customer satisfaction in California?
Previously, this has gone on for a number of years, so this is actually a reference that we're bringing up, but it is one that's been fully vetted and has been going on for, over 10 years. And the performance improvement that they got was availability of the technology staying up. At some point in time, there was much difficulty in having the underpinning technology stay up to support the business of delivering social services to the child welfare clientele. And so with the service level agreements that were talked about earlier, our contract has a set of service levels that we have to perform to with stiff penalties if we don't. And so the ability to keep the application up and running so that the social workers can use it appropriately improves significantly.
Okay, Ross.
Yeah, I have a question. I've heard the word penalties brought up probably half a dozen times already. What does that specifically mean?
Okay. in a service level agreement, in your private lives, you probably have that some as well. You know, when you're expecting, you know, someone to be, if you have an agreement on your service to your refrigerator, and if it goes down, they're supposed to come and respond to you within 3 hours to fix the refrigerator or whatever the issue is. And if they don't, usually in your agreement, you have some penalty that they have to pay you, the consumer, for not responding within the appropriate amount of time. For IBM, those are typically financial penalties that we have to pay back to the state for not, you know, responding or, you know, fixing a problem or any of those kinds of things within a defined period of time. So usually it's financial. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. All right, let's keep ourselves going.
Okay, maybe it'll help a little bit. Most of these outsource contracts, maybe this will help you a little bit, are paid for by usage. You pay by usage. So if you use more, you pay more. If you use less, you pay less. Whereas in, you know, typical implementations, if you buy a server, you've bought it. So these are paid by usage. And then when you have a service level where you've missed, then you get that paid back to you. Commonwealth of PA, they have their infrastructure. They've been long in this outsource, and now they have begun on their ERP implementation and going the way of having a managed provider, much like, you know, the child welfare in California. So that's the way some of the states have been doing it. And then if we flip to the next.
Can I just stop you just for 1 second? When it says size and scope, that's, you know, you give a number there. Are there savings that are calculated from this as well? I mean,
I don't have the savings from this one. And
okay.
I have to be always watching to make sure that it's something that the state's willing to publish, and this isn't public. They don't have theirs published.
Okay.
Other than what we have back, you know, earlier.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, and then what a managed services means and how it works is kind of in a quick little slide for you here. You know, you can do help desk, and this is now, again, from the technology side, not the business side, which, you know, Stuart will talk about, but, you know, your help desk, you can just outsource your help desk, you know, or do a managed, and I shouldn't use the word outsource, actually a managed service, because you can do it one of two ways. One, you can have somebody come in and run it for you, or you can have somebody run it, you know, from a distant site, but it's on your behalf. So there's a lot of ways to do a managed service. It doesn't always mean outsourcing, so we need to be careful with that word. Desk side support, asset management. This is a big thing for all companies, especially states, because assets, IT assets, are just dispersed everywhere. Knowing how much you actually have how much it's costing you and where it is, and not letting it get away from you, especially when you have, and then that speaks to security issues, because especially when you have people walking around with laptops that have perhaps information on it, that if the laptop has gotten legs and walked away, is information that could create a security breach. So knowing where your stuff is and being able to do an enterprise asset management also allows you to be able to refresh and keep your costs on your assets at a much lower rate. Network services, most states in some form or another have moved to a public network, but some still have their own private networks. Public networks are getting to be much less costly, and there's a multitude of ways you can use that, and you can provision on need as opposed to having to put a new pipe or a new connection in every time you need some sort of an upgrade. That one can also go out. Human resources, best practices, and then, of course, disaster recovery. You need to work with either a provider or a partner with another state or some other entity that would work with you and being able to put your environment up should a disaster happen in your where your facilities are. So this is just to kind of give you a different view of that, a one-slide view. Okay, and then you can go out and look at these. These are publicly available on their website. The state of Florida has House Bill 1892. They are in a consolidation effort. They're moving. They have 60-some agencies that are to be moving into 3 data centers over time. The state of Colorado has a Senate Bill 08-155 that is a consolidation. When you look at it, they may be doing it themselves. They may be looking at a managed service, but it is out there and you can look at it and interpret it. And then the state of Minnesota has a House file number 2299 where they're moving towards legislation for a managed service. So those are things we know is kind of happening in other states at this point. Okay, so where are the areas you can kind of find those cost savings we've been talking about? Server consolidation and virtualization, I'll talk a little bit about that. Security services, data center design, data storage optimization, network optimization. And then I wanted to put this one at the last bullet because I think it's critically important. And that is, you can't take just a gunshot approach at this and hope that you hit something that's going to help you get those savings. You really need to have a plan and a strategy to get there so you can benchmark and measure and make sure you hit your objectives. Yes, sir.
Is there any data pertinent to the state of Connecticut that's been collected already?
I have none. Jared?
Yes. I know that the Department of Information Technology has undergone a number of recent task force to accumulate some of its own data in terms of, you know, taking a look at how it's going to improve efficiencies. I'm not sure whether they've made that data public or not, but you may be able to access that directly from DOIT.
Current state information?
In terms of asset management?
In terms of what's there, networks, equipment, various data centers, are there maps, are there diagrams?
DOIT has diagrams of that, but they have it for specifically their own agency. I don't think there is a master plan within the state that outlines all the data centers that are out there, and there are several data centers. It's not just Department of Information Technology. DOT has their own data center. Department of Labor has a subset data center. Department of Corrections, the Department of Social Services, DRS, they all have their own data centers out there. And, whether all those data centers, can come together, because they all have, much like equipment out there that can easily be consolidated, because a lot of those servers that are in those outlying facilities are pretty much underutilized because they're out there running specific applications to those specific agencies.
Yvonne?
Hi.
talking, what Shelley and Jack were talking about in terms of points of measure. We're talking about the customer experience, what happens if there's a security breach and things like that. Productivity is an area of measure, cost savings, but also impact to the environment. In any of the examples that you previously shared, are people focused on that point of measure right now as well as the customer experience and cost savings?
The cost savings as it relates to, for example, the security breach, what is the cost savings?
No, a point of measure specifically being the environment. Are we saving on the carbon footprint, the energy savings?
There are studies on that we have. I don't have it in this presentation.
But our customers that are procuring these potential solutions, they're looking for that.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's the part of the whole green initiative that's underway that a lot of customers are looking at today. And we have several customers that are actually in some of the more modern data center environments. They're actually measuring their energy usage. We have intelligent software today that can actually measure the output from servers, measure the output from AC devices, powered devices, the lights that are in this room. Matter of fact, Bryant University is one of the leading universities right now in terms of energy management, where the software automatically goes out there at 2 a.m. in the morning and powers down the lights in the library. So it powers down the amount of AC current that's going into their servers because their servers aren't active at 3 a.m. in the morning. They've actually been able to save in the range of 15% to 25% in their energy bills over the last, I think it was 3 to 4 months, by just having this software in place to monitor energy usage. So yes, that's the next wave in terms of modernized data centers.
Which you don't find much in the States. That's really a new concept because of the way facilities are managed in states. And some states, the IT department may or may not even know what its energy bill is. It doesn't necessarily pay it. So they don't count it as a cost of doing business when it really truly is, right? So it's a new measure for them. And I think that's probably why we're on the kind of the infancy side of getting that type of data out of a state, because it's new and they're just starting to really look at, oh, that is a cost of doing business, how do I measure it, and then how do I improve it?
Could I make a comment? Related to energy management, and I think one of the comments was related to environmental impact and standards. Most new data centers are being constructed around LEED standards, which is great. The challenge I think we have is, and it's kind of related to this whole discussion, is many, many entities, the state, private companies as well, have older data centers, and they're truly energy hogs. And I think the state in particular has a unique position right now because of federal stimulus money. You should put some toward that, and that would help you, whether you get into an outsourcing program or not, just run more efficient data centers because they are typically the largest energy users in any entity's facilities.
Thank you very much. Are there other questions? We'll continue.
Good.
Dale's got a question.
Because Shelley mentioned a similar thing with respect to federal stimulus dollars, do you have any idea of the magnitude of savings through some specific examples of what you could save by monitoring energy usage and reducing energy usage at a data center?
I can get you some, yes.
That would be very helpful.
Just so the commission members know, we also have additional information coming on that particular, managing our assets, not just along IT, but in terms of energy and our real estate in the state. We have some additional presentations coming for the commission on that specific issue.
Yeah, one last point I want to make is what you're talking about here in terms of energy efficiency. It really has to go back to the whole idea of total cost of computing, because a lot of times when procurements come through state agencies on technology, as Renee said, they never really factor in the full cost of ownership in terms of energy usage. I heard the term LEED, LEED energy.
that has to be factored into any type of analysis when you're looking at technology, because as Renee said, the budgets for energy usage is not with the technology departments. It's over with DPUC or Public Works or wherever those utility bills come in. So unless they're seeing that, they don't really care the types of technology that they're procuring. They'll probably end up procuring, you know, the lowest price Intel server by maybe $5, but it ends up costing them, you know, $500 more on an annual basis because of the energy usage. So they really need to start factoring in those types of equations when they're looking at total cost of procurement technology.
I don't see any other hands up right now, so I think we can continue.
Okay, let's flip to the next slide then. All right, so again, this is what we're seeing, areas where you can get your highest savings, most rapid payback, and where you get low savings but a longer payback. And in those areas, in the higher savings, rapid payback, you see things like managed security services, information protection services, that's, you know, keeping viruses and those types of things at bay. They can be very costly, and that's something, again, that people don't really benchmark today. They don't realize if you have all of your IT staff running around trying to get a virus out of your environment and they're doing nothing else, that is a cost of doing business. Storage optimization, and that has a lot to do with states as well as, you know, most of the private sector today have to keep a lot of data. And you have to really look at that data and decide, is it mission critical data? Is it stuff that you can archive away, you just need to be able to get to if, you know, requested? For states, because of Open Records Acts and the types of data that are asked to be provided at you know, a moment's notice in most cases, that's really critical. And what happens in, you know, most cases is the agency storing this over here and an agency storing that over there. And how it ends up getting built is somebody says, well, I think I'm going to need about a gigabyte of storage, and you give them that. And then there's not a lot of tools that are being run that measures it and sees if anybody ever used it at all, or if they used it, if they only used 10 meg of it, you know. And that's a small number, I mean, because we're seeing things in the world of terabyte and petabyte that's happening, where they've been assigned massive amounts of storage because they think that that's what's going to happen, and then it doesn't, and it's not being dynamically moved to where somebody else might have a need. It's sitting there waiting for that to happen. And there's looking at the types of data you have, and is it critical, or is it something you can store in a much less expensive type of storage than on-demand storage? I did not put but I have it as a backup slide, an IT lifecycle management and governance. But in states, I think this is one of the most critical things to consider no matter what you do, is having a governance model that facilitates whatever you choose to do to get your cost savings. So if you're trying to consolidate, a governance model that the agencies and the central IT organization are collaborating with each other and it is in everybody's best interest to make this work is critical. If it is not in everybody's best interest to make it work, what you get is disparaging approaches to getting some of your transition and transformation done. So setting up governance models, and then life cycle, one of the questions that was raised early about, so once you do all this work, if you don't maintain it and keep it moving forward in the whole life cycle management, then over time you lose the cost of, you lose the savings you have achieved because you just kind of go back to the way it was before. And then network optimization, we talked about TEM is up there because some states are experiencing this where they have multiple telecommunications providers, and you get all these bills that are, you know, my cell phone.
I'm going to just stop you for a second. We've got can you just, TEM?
TEM, telecommunications expense management.
Okay. And
yes.
You probably want to give us one sentence on what that really means, because in addition to the commission members listening, we're on CTN, so it's anybody who's watching is going to want to know what all the ABCs stand for.
So all that means is that you get multiple bills. They're very, you know, they're very complex to read. In some cases, you'd have to be in the telecommunications business to read your own bill. And it's going in and helping organizations read their bill, make sure that they're paying for what they have, or helping them go and audit. In a lot of cases, you know, person X leaves the organization. Nobody remembers to turn person X's phone off or their network connection off. And it just is overrun in expense. So it's really going in and auditing and helping an organization see where they're spending their money on telecommunications and if there's any efficiencies they can get out of that.
Is that a service that IBM provides or something that, you know, you...
IBM does it. A lot of companies do
it. A lot of companies do it, because I will just let the commission members know that in our auditing, we have a board of auditors that goes through all of our state agencies. This is a consistent, recurring recommendation from our auditors. When someone leaves an agency, following up on whether they've gotten, you know, their cell phone's been turned in, whether their computer's been turned off. It's a consistent, recurring recommendation from our auditors as a way that money is just flying out the state's door. So I think that's something for us to pay attention to.
It is one of the practices where we, as you see, find quite quickly savings, 3 to 9 months, 15%. It's a quick
15%
win.
15% of what?
Of your overall bill. Yeah, we'll go through these quickly. So you can look at these later, but these are, I gave you some ideas on the types of savings you could have when you take, and Jerry brought it up early. You have all the servers that are sitting out and everywhere, being able to bring those into one environment and be able to use what we call virtualization. They use less power consumption. You can manage them dynamically, so you can put an application on multiple applications on one environment, as opposed to the way things are typically set up. And it's just a legacy thing that's happened. You know, when you have a new application you want to run, typically folks go out and buy a new server and a whole new environment and set it up. You don't need to do that. And what is critical about this is one of the things that we've worked on is when you have agencies that use federal funding, it's always been a concern that they have to keep the environment so isolated so they can report back that nothing is being paid for that shouldn't be under that federal funding. There are now tools that are out there that help you look at a virtualized environment and be able to exactly identify what is being used for that application or that program, and you can report it back without having to have very separate environments for it. So the funding issues about virtualization have kind of been squashed with the software and technologies that we have out there now that can account for how your servers are being used, how your storage is being used, and what exactly is being allocated to that down to the desktop if you want it that way. So you can look at all that. Managed security services means somebody else completely, you know, people whose core business it is to watch for security threats, security issues, viruses, you know, spyware, all of that is running that for you. That is not an easy business to be in. We just can't keep up with the kids that are better hackers than we are, you know, keeping them out. So people who do that every day on the legal side of things are much better at that, and managed security services are very much sought after for cost savings. Then you stay in the business of setting the policy and making sure that what you want monitored, what you want secured, and how you want that done is articulated. Somebody else just does the business of the business. Data center design, we talked about this. You can find up to at least 50% operational cost savings from energy efficient designs. And you can look at, you know, across the size of any types of data center. If you take multiple ones away and put it in one and you efficiently design that, there's some cost savings again on your energy. Since we're going through these quickly, stop me if you need something here.
I'm going to stop you on the data center design and consolidation. You know, in terms of, I understand the savings in that you're going from multiple data centers that have multiple energy and space needs and personnel costs and along those lines. But when you consolidate a data center, does that also change the actual way you are retrieving the data?
No, but it does change the way you might be storing it or keeping it in the environment, because you move, in a lot of these cases, it's not just about the energy and the cooling on the floor, but it's about how you build the equipment and the infrastructure on the floor so it runs more efficiently, so it requires less of the power and cooling of the data center. Some new technologies that are out that allow you to power down systems that aren't critical systems during the night, so they're not using energy. Some things that we can do in different ways that we cool so it doesn't put as much stress on the whole plant but keeps a particular area cool. So it goes across the divide of anything from cooling and energy on the actual data center floor to the way the infrastructure that sits on it is designed and utilized.
Thank you.
Question? Is it necessary, when you talk about data center design and achieving these benefits, is it necessary to have the state own the data center?
No.
Can't you just rely on a private source to provide the data center and build in all those savings?
Either way. You can do it either way. In Georgia, they had this is another term. It's called a Tier 4 data center, which is something called by Uptime Institute. Uptime Institute has criteria that measures the a data center's efficiency and redundancy and reliability. So, you know, whether or not level tornado can hit it and not have damage and that type of thing, how much redundancy it has built into it. So the higher the number from Uptime Institute, the more redundant and the higher availability you're going to get out of your data center. So Georgia already had that. They had moved into it about 2 years before. And, you know, since we did this one, I can speak to this. It was decided that it was more cost efficient, rather than moving everything somewhere else, to move all the agencies into that one and then consolidate their environment and make the environment on the floor even more efficient. So you can, or you can ask that a provider, and when Georgia wrote their RFP, they said, we don't care. You tell us which way is most cost effective. So in most cases, that's how it works. You said you ask, hey, how's it most cost effective? Depending on what you have and what's available to the vendor, they'll come back with either or option. Storage optimization, I talked about that quite a bit. You know, if you want me to cover it anymore, but you have to hit the screen thing again. It's a fly-in. Sorry. You'll see what, you know, where your cost savings can be. Your environment is one of those, as we talked about. Backup and recovery, this is important in when you're trying to recover in a DR situation or in a business continuity situation. In states, because of all the different ways you can be asked to provide information, and it is lots of times asked at a moment's notice, being able to retrieve your most critical data, your most recent data, fast is where you put your most expensive storage. When it's stuff that you might have to just dig back through the archives and provide something, then you move that off to the really cheap storage. And there's a lot of different ways to get to the cheaper storage. Network infrastructure optimization, again, you know, we talked about that already, but here's the types of things you could look at: moving to a public network, moving to voice over IP, you know, getting those costs down. A lot of people have heard about that today. You know, certainly, you know, there's Skype and all those things out there we're all used to now. And being able to move and bring your costs down by putting things like telepresence up or, you know, video conferencing so you don't have to travel as much in bigger states, that's a cost. And then the last one in here, again, is this planning. Do it with a plan. Think about improving your internal efficiencies. Where are you gonna focus, and what is it that it already costs you, so you have a benchmark to start with and you can measure what your outcome is. Just picking an area and saying, hey, I think I'm going to go after this and this will probably yield me this savings. If you don't have a good plan for it, how you're going to execute, and even perhaps some help in getting this done. And one of the questions earlier, there are a number of very good companies out there that can come in and help do the benchmark, the type of asset management studies that you need to do, the type of efficiency studies, and tell you where your best cases are in either doing it yourself, having somebody come in and transform your environment, having a managed service outsourcing thing, and then helping you build a plan and what we call a roadmap to get there.
Yeah, Renee, do most of the other states that you've worked with or aware of have somebody come in and do a full study of the...
Yes, you'll see there's...
Of the as-is.
Mm-hmm. If you look, you'll see there's a common name probably in most of them.
I've worked.
Yeah. So there's a common one or two names that, because they're very good at this. They're very good. They have templates and methodologies which expedite the process. They've done it in public procurement before, so they understand the public procurement process. And they, most of them, if you look at the ones that have done this, they get them through. And, you know, this is a hard thing to do, especially something like this, without protest. Right? So they have methodology. So you'll see, like, common names start coming out. But, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And then we're going to let Stuart go from there. So I just kind of... Again, wanted to share with y'all what other states are doing, approaches you could consider, and then Stuart's going to share with you the programmatic approach you could consider.
Thank you very much, Renee. Are there any questions for Renee? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stuart is a managing partner with IBM Global Services, responsible for our human service agencies and helping from a programmatic efficiency perspective. In his former life, he has been director of several human services agencies in the Washington, D.C. area, so he has hands-on experience with managing and operating these types of agencies, and we're going to take you through the programmatic side of the health and human service types of agencies. Obviously, there's many agencies within the executive branches of state government, but in this case, we thought we'd focus on the social service types of agencies since they are very large program-oriented agencies and certainly take up a big part of the budget. So with that said, Stuart?
So thanks very much for the opportunity to share our perspective on how human services agencies can reduce costs while at the same time improving or at least maintaining client outcomes. Our presentation will offer our perspective on the issues facing human services agencies today, on how agencies can and I think must move forward to become more efficient and more effective and more responsive to the clients they serve. And we'll offer some examples and suggestions about what other jurisdictions are doing. So by their very nature, human services agencies are counter-cyclical. Just as the demand for services increases for human services agencies, the resources available to meet that demand decline, right? It's an unusual business model in human services. Demand peaks, but your resources decline. In addition, because in human services, particularly the traditional benefit programs, tend to serve those that are, in the broader economy, sort of the first fired and last hired. Right? So what we can expect is that there's been a rapid increase in food stamps and other caseloads. We can expect that increase to continue, and we can expect that higher level of caseloads and applications to sustain well after the economy has turned around. So this new level of high demand and relatively low resources, I don't think for most human services agencies is a temporary situation. This is sort of the new normal. They have to actually get used to delivering services in this new environment. So this creates creates what we call a product. Sorry, I speak with my hands. I apologize. Create what we call a productivity gap. Just as to meet this higher caseload, at the end of the day, what human services agencies have to do is to find a way to increase their productivity. We think that technology is key to that. It's not just about technology, but we think technology has to become a force multiplier for the human services agency. They have to be able to make their remaining workforce much more productive to meet the ongoing demand for services. Okay, all right, that's good. So historically, human services agencies have looked at technology differently than that. In the first wave of using technology in human services, we really focused on making things faster, really making things more efficient. There's nothing wrong with that, but generally in human services, there's really three dimensions we care about. We want to be as efficient as possible, we want to be responsive to our clients as possible, and we want to be effective. At the end of the day, we want to make sure that we are delivering poor service at a low cost. We want to be sure that we're delivering good service and real outcomes at the lowest possible cost. So we've dealt the first wave of technology. We developed things like automated eligibility systems, which were built to process high volumes of similar types of transactions, right? Very quickly and very reliably. And to this day, they still do that. But the nature of human services has changed now, and these automated eligibility systems and these old legacy applications are now rigid, very difficult to maintain, very difficult to enhance, and really often become a constraint on how human services are delivered rather than an enabler on how we could deliver human services. So agencies will actually develop policies or procedures around the limitations of their applications rather than in a model they think would really be more effective in delivering services. More recently, we saw a second wave of applying technology to human services agencies. And this was really about improving access, not necessarily access to ongoing services, but access to information in some often limited transactions. So we saw web-based front ends for some clients and for workers as well. So workers now, in most places, have easier access to client information than they may have had a few years ago. But the driver for all of this, again, was, although there was some element of efficiency, was really around responsiveness. It was really about making sure that clients had some better access to services through screening applications or being able to conduct simple transactions over the web. Again, they were primarily designed to improve responsiveness. So what we see is a third wave of technology and its application to human services. And at IBM, we call this smart human services, right? And this is really about using technology to drive better client outcomes while at the same time being more efficient and more responsive. This is, in smarter human services, it's not just about technology. It's really about integrating technology, processes, and people to improve outcomes. And I'm being able to allocate the limited resources that human services agencies have to where they have the greatest impact on clients, right, the most cost-effective model. So while our view of smart human services covers a broad array of initiatives, and we'll talk about a couple of these in just a second, they really share three things in common. So they are all what we call interconnected. They all share information safely and securely with each other, and they provide a more comprehensive and coordinated approach to serving human services clients. And they're all insightful. And they take advantage of the tremendous amounts of data sitting in human services systems today. So I'll take this opportunity to give you my personal soapbox issue, which Shelley has heard 100 times before, which is that nobody collects more information about their clients than human services agencies. And without exception that I've seen, really, nobody uses it less effectively. Tons and tons of information going back 20, 30, 40 years around clients, and it just sits there fallow. Right? We don't really use it. And there's a tremendous amount of value in that information and a tremendous amount of insight we can gain about the types of programs that work and that don't work and the types of segments of clients that we serve more effectively. So we sit on this tremendous amount of raw data. And I think this next wave of smart human services is going to use that raw data, turn it into real information, and then apply it, which is the next I here, intelligently. Right? The systems are intelligent. They're going to apply the lessons we've learned to help workers make better decisions about, at the client level, to help make very specific decisions about what, for example, the most appropriate treatment might be for a client. They also help the agencies at a sort of a macro level make better decisions about where to allocate funding, which programs to continue and to continue funding, and which programs perhaps let sunset. Yes, sir.
The software that would be more insightful, does that exist? Do the analytic that's already exist, or does each agency, let's say in the state of Connecticut, have to design what they want to know?
So there's the short answer is there's the bit more than just the basic tooling to do this sort of stuff. There are analytical tools that allow you to do that, right? Reporting tools and business intelligence tools and modeling tools. There are emerging some specific models that can help do this stuff, but it's not a fully mature industry. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question. The tools are all there.
You mean modeling tools, the tools necessary to build this kind of performance?
Yes. So the, yes.
But you still need business rules, in essence.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's where the
and
that's, where
that's
the
what's missing, correct?
Yes. So you have to you. Yes, the short story is you have to understand the data, you have to analyze the data, you have to sort of learn the lessons the data can teach you, develop a model and test it to understand how you apply that data to the decisions you make.
So to be clear, if an agency has an overwhelming body of data that could be used in this way, that agency would probably have to have its subject matter experts sit down and ask the kinds of questions they needed to ask of the data that was there to produce the insight. It's not just inherently there.
Yes, there's
it's an opportunity. It's not an existing.
Yes, you have to ask the right questions. There are some of that is asking the right questions.
Right.
Some of that is actually information that does. There are tools that help you analyze the data that will help tease out some of the information. But yes, it is not a push a button and it's done situation. It's real work to do, but it's really there. And the insights I think that we would gain from doing that kind of work are pretty impressive.
So to be clear, it's an opportunity that would present itself to some of the various state agencies if the state agencies have the personnel to take advantage of it.
Yes.
Okay.
So that, sorry, I guess so what we can call intelligent is to be able to take this insight and then apply that systematically to the decisions that agencies make every day, right? Decisions they make about clients, decisions they make about programs, decisions they make about their own staff. Okay. Next slide. So we see five broad areas where we think this notion of smart human services can make a difference. So real quickly, one of them is smart access. So providing clients with, for example, common, easily understood methods to connect with the broad array of government-sponsored programs, and perhaps more importantly, with the tremendous amount of resources and programs available to the community that aren't sponsored by government. And we'll talk about a specific example of that in just a minute. And to help them make this stuff available through what we call channels, different channels, so over the web, over the phone, or in person. Another example of smart human services is around smart decisions. I think this is essentially what we were talking about before, but basically taking advantage of all the data that's out there and using that to help make better decisions at the micro and macro level. Smart service delivery. Particularly now in an age of budget crisis, I think agencies would be well served to really focus on what their core mission is and understand what it is that they need to be doing and where that might make sense for them to consolidate with other agencies, to perhaps eliminate a service because it's duplicative in the broader environment, to look to the private sector, meaning not necessarily firms like ours, but also community providers to actually take on some of that work, or to just share services in the back end. I think we'll talk about that in a second as well. There's always value in just improving the business processes. Often business processes sort of evolve organically, and every time you talk to a human services worker, you end up, like in any organization, sort of recognize that this is not how you would design the business process today if you could build it from scratch. You can take a very focused approach to some business processes and drive real savings really, really quickly. Through re-engineering the business process. And the fifth area is an area we call smart workforce. And we'll talk about this in a second as well, but as part of improving the productivity of human services workers and workers more generally, there's a lot we can do to give them the decision support tools and the training and the skills enhancements and the ability to work collaboratively that can help workers become more productive and become more flexible so you can apply them to the areas you need them when you need them. One point we want to make as we go on, though, is that we often focus in these sorts of circumstances on trying to drive out some of the administrative costs or the back-end costs for human services. But particularly in human services, administrative costs are really a small fraction of the overall program costs. Often it's 10% or less, but by far the vast majority of program budgets go to providing services and benefits to end clients. So to really drive efficiencies and to really find the savings that everybody is looking for, we need to not only focus on the administrative elements, but we also have to look at how we can reduce program costs, because small changes in program costs can swamp any savings really available in the administrative costs. For example, a simple example, tailoring programs using the data that's already there to understand what programs are more effective in moving people to self-sufficiency. Just reducing the amount of time that people spend on, for example, a TANF benefit, a temporary needy families benefit, is a tremendous amount of savings to the state. If you could just reduce that by a month or 2 months, or in unemployment insurance, if somebody can if you can help somebody find a job a week or two earlier, that's actually a tremendous amount of savings to the state if you could do that across the vast, the large number of people you're serving today. So with that in mind, I'd like to talk about a couple of examples of how we think you can help drive some of these savings and improved outcomes. So one approach is to look at human services agencies as a single enterprise. This is something of an eye chart, I apologize, but I'll explain it hopefully. To look at them as a single enterprise and then to decompose them into their basic business components. And we use a technique at IBM called component business modeling, and this is a component business model, sort of a reference model for human services agencies generally. It doesn't reflect any specific human services agency, sort of our view on what a human services agency would look like. The key thing is we've represented these components, and you can do the same thing, without regard to where they sit organizationally. And if you have questions about any of these, I'll be happy to answer them. But when you take away the organizational context, it actually exposes the amount of commonality, right? So all of these agencies have human resources. All of these agencies have, I shouldn't say all of them, but most of them, some sort of banking operations. They have some sort of quality assurance system, right? They have hearings and appeals or some sort of remediation, right? They all have these sorts of things. And what we can do is look at all these things and see where we actually have duplication, and then we can make informed judgments about where it might make sense to consolidate, for one agency to share services, so maybe a couple of agencies can actually combine forces to do things more efficiently. Maybe you effectively outsource a function to another state agency. Right? They may have a better competency at something, so why do it yourselves if you can rely on another state agency, for example, to do it more effectively? And it doesn't necessarily have to be just the back-end functions, although sort of intuitively that's really the first place to look is these back-end functions, but really there's a lot of client-facing functions that can also be perhaps consolidated or shared. So even outreach and intake and those sorts of things are often spread across a half dozen or more human services agencies. There's no reason why, in theory, you can't consolidate some of that work. Any questions on... That was sort of a large picture example. Another example around what we call smart access, and this is an example from the state of Utah, where they created where Utah worked with its existing 211 directory. And for folks who don't know, 211 directories are phone referral services often provided by community organizations like the United Way. In fact, in Connecticut, it is provided by the United Way. And you can call on the phone, and they'll help direct you to resources in the community. So what Utah did is actually created a screening application that's integrated with the existing 211 directory and allows clients to do a few things. It allows clients to assess their needs, right? So you don't go into this Utah care system having to know the programs you want. You go into this new Utah care system understanding what your needs are, and there's an interview-driven process that helps better define the client's needs. Then it actually, based on those needs and other information...
Excuse me, sir. The person who's doing that interview in Utah, though, is not a state worker.
So it's actually, there's multiple channels. It is not a state worker if it's done over the phone, and it's also done over the web. So it's actually a web application.
Okay, so then under those circumstances, it's self-directed.
It is. It's completely self-directed. And the intent, although it, as a practical matter, what we found is that a large number of people who are actually use the application are not the clients themselves, but perhaps advocates for the client, folks in a church-based shelter or a community ministry or those sorts of things, right, where they're actually using this as a tool to help connect folks. And the important part here is that what Utah did is different than most other states have done, is that Utah didn't view itself as the provider of first resort. Its goal was not to make... was not simply to make life easier for folks who wanted to apply for government services. Their goal was actually to help clients in need, people in need, find the community-based resources first that might be able to help them. So once you identify the need, either on the phone or on the web, you're actually presented with a list of community resources that might be able to help you, with a bunch of detailed information about who they serve and how they serve and where they are and directions and what they require, et cetera. But it also includes the state-administered programs as well. If the client is interested in understanding whether or not they might be eligible for a state-funded benefit, they have pre-eligibility screenings. So we can go through them with a high degree of confidence. We have another interview. We ask some questions about, or the state of Utah, rather, ask some questions about their income, their assets, their family size, et cetera, and can give them a pretty clear indication about whether they're likely to be eligible for a broad array of benefits. And then they can actually begin the application process for some of those benefits.
So I always have to interject something here, but this is a very important point that Stuart is talking about, and that you absolutely picked up the point of it all. In terms of a cost savings approach, states are really looking at this kind of capability because it is self-directed. It is a person in need without the aid, actually, if they go online, of a social worker from a state agency going through and self-assessing and looking and determining whether or not it is appropriate for them to go to a state agency and, you know, take the time of the state agency worker, if you will, to go to more detailed eligibility determination. This is not going on in Connecticut today. Connecticut does not have this capability as the Department of Social Services today, as far as I know. And as a matter of fact, I think it's something that the Department of Social Services may go forward with in the future. But the point is that you want folks, many people nowadays have access to the Internet, to go in and do self-directed, self-determination of what kind of benefit that they could potentially be eligible for or not be eligible for and therefore not come into a state agency to receive services. They would also be knowledge. They would also get the information about what's available from the community.
And I have a question in that regard. People may know or may not know that the United Way of Connecticut was the pioneer in adopting 211. And one of the capabilities that it has in some of the databases that it maintains is actually knowing not just that a service is theoretically available, but whether it's actually available. So, for example, whether a particular daycare center has an opening or not. And I wondered, you know, as you design these programs, whether these web-based applications are able to say not only, you know, you're eligible for care for kids, child care subsidy, but here are programs that actually provide daycare for an evening shift worker for a child who's disabled. And then secondarily, whether you then are able to gather the metrics about particular community-based service providers who are at capacity, so that in different parts of the state, so you know when you're exceeding the capacity of the human services community to meet the needs that you're identifying.
So if I can, the short answer is yes to both of those questions. I think there were two. you can, right? So in Utah, it's actually truly integrated with the 211 directory. They're going after the same repository of information around the community providers. It's the same exact information updated by Community College and United Way of Utah. This issue of availability is a tricky one, and so states have looked at that differently. States have looked at that very differently, but it's certainly technically possible. It's actually not the issue is never the technology. The issue here is, how confident are you that you actually will have an accurate picture based on, the availability of resources? So often what happens is states will decide that, we can give you a referral and you need to make. The one other point I would make, another advantage of these sorts of systems is not only do they help you tell you where you do have services, they also help tell you where you don't, right? So when people come in and they ask for or screen for services, you can actually collect information about what they're looking for and whether you were able to provide them and help, therefore, become a catalyst to providing services in the community more broadly. Sir?
I have a question, and it really goes back to, use an old term, user-friendly. How are the people that are on this Utah system, they like it better than whatever the old way was? That's really the question. How has it been adopted by the ultimate users, the folks who need the help?
So I wish I had usage statistics about the city of Utah. I don't. But what I can tell you is that we spent a lot of time around. So to get to the user-friendly issue, that's an obstacle all the time, right? Because the truth is that we are designing these applications for folks who do not always, but who generally have a lower education level. And so we spend a lot of time making sure that we word the questions correctly, that we try and provide questions in the right language. And in fact, in the city of Utah, it's actually provided in several languages, at least two, with others on the way, I believe. So we do spend a lot of time on that. It did actually get, I know initially it got greater take-up than they had planned, but I don't know the extent to which, it's been used. I don't know their exact usage statistics. I can try and find them.
Just a personal comment. I think all municipal city states have to be sensitive to the balance of cost savings and pushing things toward people who are under a lot of stress right now. There's a lot of cuts across everybody. A lot of people are struggling. And if it's the degree of difficulty to access services, particularly for first-time folks, is frustrating, that's not going to help. And I think we have to stay sensitive to that. And perhaps that's already built into the programs you have, but workarounds or ways people can quickly, if they're struggling with the self-directed approach, they can get help quick.
Sure. So just to give Utah an example, it's an absolutely legitimate concern. And in IBM, we generally view this as one of several avenues, right, to get to the array of services. So in Utah, it is completely integrated with the 211 directory. So if a phone call is easier, they can certainly call. If they'd like to, they can go into the office, and a worker will work with them to screen. And, of course, I mentioned earlier, there's community organizations that use this tool as well sit side by side with potential clients. So absolutely, we think it's best to have a broad array of channels and find the most convenient. And where they use a more cost-effective channel, that's all to the good.
A comment, actually. For those of you who are interested, The Price of Government by David Osborne and Peter Hutchins in Chapter 9 provides some backup for this point and support for it.
I think they got it from us. No.
Thank you. That would be good.
Okay, all good comments.
I'll go to the next one. Another example of a state that has taken a much more ambitious approach to modernization is the state of Indiana. And just to give you the background here, this is, earlier you asked Renee about outsourcing the technology components of a human services agency. In Indiana, this is actually outsourcing the service delivery components of a human services agency. So there's a coalition of agency organizations led by IBM that is responsible for virtually all of the case management and eligibility functions for these for the broad array of programs in the state of Indiana's Family and Social Services Agency. So although we're very proud of the work we're doing there, the savings that we're helping the state of Indiana drive aren't all necessarily due to outsourcing models. Some of them could be driven by a couple of other things. And, so really there are three principles that are driving the state of Indiana's modernization program. One of them, to get to the conversation we heard just a second ago, was they want to move clients where possible. They want to move the client interactions and transactions to sort of the lowest cost channel. So they are moving from offices in every county and the requirement that folks come into the office to do interviews to a model of call centers. And I think they've established, I think it's three, it may not be exactly correct, three call centers, and moving much of the work to call centers and then to the web as well. So clients are going to be able to conduct some transactions over the web, things like updating their addresses and those sorts of things. One of the things in human services agencies is a remarkable amount of time is actually spent on things like updating cases, a bunch of case information. So that's actually a really important lever to pull to help reduce costs. The second thing they're doing in Indiana is they're re-engineering their business processes and they're establishing and enforcing best practices in all offices. So many states actually have a very sort of disparate organization, and the processes and procedures in vary by county office and county office. What they're moving to is a more centralized model where they establish best practices and they enforce it across the entire organization. And the third major thing is that they're using document management. So they are moving away from a paper-based system and moving to a modern document management system where information is scanned and readily available to anybody who needs to and has the authority to see that information.
Stuart, can you just talk, in terms of talking about what's going on in Indiana, can you tell me, what the level of satisfaction is with regard to customer care and the accuracy of determinations and timeliness?
So, to be honest, I don't know the details. I know that there has been issues that the IBM Coalition and the state are working through around a couple of timeliness issues. I think those are progressing well, and I know that they have been improving over the last few months, but I don't know specifics about where they stand. But again, we could get you in touch with the right people if you're interested.
I think obviously for us, for this commission, I think also for the legislature, and I'm sure for the administration, ultimately, we are looking to balance this cost savings, but not at the expense of anybody's service level. We want to make sure that we have the appropriate balance of customer satisfaction and client satisfaction in there. So, I'm very interested. This particular slide, I think probably I have would have a lot of questions on going forward. So.
Sure, I'm happy to.
Sure.
If you move to the next slide. Another example is more of what we call the smart decisions that we talked about earlier. In this case, it's a program we call intelligent processing at the U.S. Social Security Administration. So the SSA, Social Security Administration, processes millions of claims for disability assistance in addition to the retirement claims that we think about SSA mostly for. And as part of the disability process, the beneficiaries have to be reviewed for their ongoing eligibility for disability. Historically, every review required a full medical review, which is a costly proposition. And so the cost of these, what they call continuing disability reviews, ran into the billions every year. What SSA realized is if they could identify among their existing clients those clients that they had a high degree of confidence would actually continue to qualify for the benefit, they could actually develop a fast path for continuing a disability review and eliminate the full medical review and actually have a more abbreviated medical review. And the SSA, they have a large volume, so a small amount of savings, in this case a few hundred dollars per claim, actually drives enormous savings across all of their claimants. And so they did is they actually, pretty much the process we talked about earlier, they actually looked at their historical data, they identified the circumstances that would allow them to predict with some confidence that the that a particular client would continually eligible for a benefit. They actually went back and tested that model. So they go back, they create a model, and they go test it on historical data to tweak it and see how accurate they can get it. They actually discovered that they developed a model that was actually more accurate than human beings making this decision. And then they are able to apply that model to ongoing cases and essentially route a fraction of those who come in for disability reviews to a fast path model. And that has a couple of tremendous benefits. First, it saves a significant amount of money because it allows the state to apply, in this case SSA, to apply resources where they can do the most value. There was no real value in processing a medical review for somebody for whom medical review added no value. Right? So they eliminate that step. They also are it's a much faster review process for those folks, right? So they're not ever in limbo. They know very quickly that they're going to continue the disability. There's no interruption in service. So eliminate a lot of the customer service issues that they've had over the years. And tremendous success. And I think that is a model, that type of application of intelligent processing is a sort of model that we see for making smart decisions. I think this gets to your conversation earlier about whether the tools are out there. The tools are out there. You have to define the model. It's the model that takes the heavy lifting. And then the way it works is you continually refine the model based on the ongoing information. So you're always tweaking the model to make it better. I'll take one last one. So finally, I mentioned this earlier about this notion of smart workforce. So human services agencies today may be near or in a worker-related crisis. Beyond the painful reductions of reductions in force that many states are adopting, and I think Connecticut is among those, agencies also face historically ongoing high turnover among particularly frontline staff, and are also facing a brain drain in most places of retirement eligible or near retirement eligible cohorts of the most experienced workers. The human services agencies today face a future where they have fewer employees who are generally less experienced and who don't stay as long as they have in the past. Right, it's a difficult proposition to move forward on. So to meet that challenge, we think what human services agencies have to do is to help make employees more productive more quickly and provide the ability for them to be more flexible so they can be, they can help you where you need them to help. So as a simple example, in many places, there are folks who specialize in the in processing applications for food stamps. And today, those are in high demand because food stamps are at an all-time high. I think you can safely expect that in the next few months, you'll see a similar increase in programs like TANF and medical assistance. I don't know where things sit in Connecticut, but in many states, the folks that are working on food stamps actually can't process TANF claims or can't process medical assistance claims. That's actually an area where technology can help. Right? We can actually develop decision support tools and some of the routing tools we talked about earlier so that folks who are who are processing food stamps today can relatively easily process TANF cases tomorrow and medical assistance cases, which are, to be fair, much more difficult. The day after tomorrow. We also, part of this is about also providing role-based learning sort of on demand. The traditional training model for human services agencies is to pull people off the line, pull them off, from where they're working, have them go through a training and often a very lengthy, and I have a history of this myself, not always the most scintillating training, and then returning back to the line. But most places in the private sector have moved to a model of an on-demand training environment, right, where we provide you with a relatively self-enclosed small amount of training when you need it, right? If you're about to do something, we'll train you on that now. So that's one way to help provide workers, help make workers more productive. You don't have to train them on everything at first. We can train them, give them the skills they need to perform certain functions, and then help them develop those skills as you need them to move into other functions. Another area that, kids these days are all about having collaborative tools, right, whether in their private lives, whether it's texting or Facebook or any of these other things. That's just the way they're used to doing business in their personal lives, and they expect that in their professional lives. So we actually, not just we, but other agencies, can bring, knowledge and collaboration tools. They can help workers to share information more effectively, to work collaboratively, to resolve a client's issues and help improve outcomes. And make sure that everybody is aware of a client's circumstances and their interactions more broadly with all of the human service agencies in the state. And then finally, I think this gets to a question that was raised earlier around what we call work-first analytics, right? But it's really about how productive are your workers? How are they performing? How can you help them become more productive? And it can be used to help identify individual worker performance, but it can also be used to help more broadly identify where you're having shortcomings, where you might see bottlenecks, where you see workers struggling because they might not have the right tools or they might just be overloaded with cases or whatever. So today, typically, you find out that there's an issue in your agency because all hell breaks loose. You have to respond to it. A better model would be to be able to see these things emerging because you have analytics in place that give you an early warning about where an issue might be emerging before it all develops into a crisis, allow you to quickly take action, for example, reallocate resources or spend more management time on an issue to help prevent crisis from occurring. We call that, generally we refer to that whole notion as what we call smart workforce. So that's, if there are any questions. Then I did want to just thank you very much for your time. Jerry will wrap up, but I also wanted to mention that we did have some white papers that we developed on a related topic with Jared, and if you're interested.
Thank you, Stuart. All right, so we'll just quickly wrap up here. Senator, first of all, thank you for your time and thank you for inviting us in here today to hopefully give you some innovative ideas and thoughts as to how the state of Connecticut can face this challenge that many states are facing right now. So we know you have a big task ahead of you, and hopefully the presentations today will give you some ideas as to how you can further address some of those specific areas. Are there any questions whatsoever in regards to either presentation this morning? We could certainly handle those today. And if not, we'll be glad to stick around after the presentation.
Hang on one second. You got one.
Just a a bigger picture question. In terms of, and I know that you have not been retained by the state to conduct any in-depth research into what we have. I don't know what you know of what is already here in terms of our ERP system or the various servers that we have.
Right.
Data centers, I'm sorry. So I don't know if you have any basic knowledge of that. Because I'm just trying to, in looking at primarily the first presentation, what is, and I understand it's a more generic presentation, but what is it that we're doing that could be improved, or are we just, or is there a wholesale change required in what we're doing, or are we meeting are we halfway to where you think we should be? And again, understanding that you're coming into this I don't want to say generic presentation because that doesn't, it's an informational presentation, but but we've got to go back and sort of then take a look at what we have and how does it relate to what was presented here.
Sure.
I may not be saying that clearly, but...
No, I understand that. I mean, obviously, we have to be very careful because as a state of Connecticut contract holder, mm-hmm. we certainly didn't want to put ourselves into a position where we're not able to respond to the state on mm-hmm. Future technology activities or business activities. So that's why we made this very much a generic sales presentation today. But to answer your question, Yes, there is a lot of information that we have accumulated over the years. I've been supporting the state of Connecticut now for almost 20 years, so I have a very strong knowledge of the information technology needs and backgrounds of the state of Connecticut, and we certainly have a lot of statistics that are out there. You know, from the whether it's the comptroller's organization's ERP systems, you know, Department of Labor's unemployment insurance applications, you know, Department of Information Technology's support of, you know, the various state agencies, because they do act as a cost center for many of the state agencies and host, do their own hosting for some of the major applications, such as, you know, you know, welfare, eligibility determination, the state police collect system, et cetera. So we do have a lot of information out there. Do we have our own thoughts and ideas? Yes. We share them, you know, obviously, you know, through our representation when we meet with those specific agencies.
Following up on that, one of the things that I was going to ask, and we were careful about this presentation, because if the commission were to decide that we wanted to go forward with some of these proposals, we have to follow, obviously, all of the procurement procedures for RFPs or whatever it is that we would be interested in, and make sure that there is a level playing field. So to some extent, I think we're, you know, constrained by that. On the other hand, you know, knowing that IBM has some of has obviously contracts with the state right now, and has had experience with the state, is that if this commission were interested in particular items that were mentioned here, would you be able to then provide us with some more specific, here's some thoughts on what we could do here in Connecticut?
We would love and welcome that opportunity, Senator. Yes.
Right, well, that will ultimately be, I think, the decision of the commission as to where, you know, people want to be going with that. So I'll let you conclude if you're.
Sure.
I'll just let you conclude your remarks, and then we'll jump to the commission.
Thank you. And obviously, again, we you know, we do have a vested interest in helping you. We've stated that before. One of the organizations that I do want to point out in summary here, there's an association, it's called the National Association of State CIOs. I've listed it here in the last summary chart. I don't think I provided this, and I'll make sure I get it to Jared for distribution. But if you go to just www.naco.org, this, again, it's a national organization of state CIOs. They actually have a repository of publications that they keep online that have been put together from various states. And there's two that I think that are of, would be very interested in terms of, you know, agency consolidation, enterprise data center consolidation, and actual survey that states did in regards to data center consolidation and shared services. So if you actually go out to those two links, you may find an abundance of information that may be helpful to the commission. And if there are no more questions, again, we thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you.
And thank you so much for being here, and I thank all the members of your team, Stuart, Renee, and Shelley in particular, for presenting today and being here to answer our questions and give us just an overview of what is out there technologically. I think the commission after this will have to decide, you know, if there are bits and pieces or in whole that of the things that we're interested in chasing down. But I do want to thank you. I do also want to let you know that almost all of the states that you've spoken about, I have spoken with. And in particular, you got rave reviews from Georgia. They had nothing but fine things to say about the efforts at consolidation, so I did want to pass that along to you and let you know that that we, you know, we are certainly looking around to make sure that we're doing everything we can possibly here in the state to make things right, but that Georgia in particular is very, very excited about the work that you're doing. So with that, I thank you very much for being here. And as to the commission members and our invited guests, I thank you all for participating. Is there additional recommendations that the members of the commission or our invited guests have in terms of, you know, what additional information do we need? where do we need to go from here? You know, you can answer this now, you can answer this later, but if there are particular comments anybody would like to make at this time, I'd be welcome to take them. I will tell you one thing we've learned from this is we're going to change the configuration because I will certainly have whiplash by the time I am done here tonight, Jared. But I would like to thank our invited guests in particular for being here today. We thank you for your expertise and for your questions, and we look forward to continuing to work with you. With that, our next commission meeting is a field hearing on Tuesday, April 28th in New Haven, and then on Thursday, April 30th in Danbury. So I welcome all the commission members and anybody who's watching this on public television. Please come and tell us what you think we could be doing here better in state government. We're looking forward to hearing from you. And with that, if there are no other questions or comments, again, I'd like to thank IBM for being here, and we will be adjourned.